Today on Vox Talks Economics, populism and war. Welcome to the first of a short series of Vox Talks Economics, based on presentations at the third Kiel CEPR conference on geoeconomics. It took place in Berlin in October this year. My name is Tim Phillips. The quintessential populist. That's Donald Trump, of course. And as he prepares to take power in the US, a timely paper presented at the conference investigates the effect that populist rulers in economic superpowers have on international relations and conflict risk and inequality as well. Massimo Morelli of Bocconi University is one of the authors, and he joins me now. Massimo, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, team. Thanks for having me.
That description of Donald Trump as the quintessential populist, that was taken from your paper. What are the aspects of Trump's policy agenda that qualify him as this quintessential populist?
Yes, populism is characterized by strategies employed by parties and politicians and movements to respond to what seems to be a deep change in the demand of policies by people. What people want in a time in which they do not trust traditional politics, they do not trust governments' representatives, they do not trust markets either. They want some policy commitments that are simple and monitorable. They want walls. Typically, they want exclusion policies. Trump is quintessential because that's from the very beginning what he did, proposing a policy of exclusion, blocks, protectionism, disengagement.
The Donald Trump's populism is famously motivated by a transactional attitude to economic considerations, the art of the deal. Through what channels does this translate into what we're talking about today, the conduct of international relations?
Yes, international relations, you can divide it in two parts, right? Trade relations, which also have cooperation relations, of course, on all the positive sides. And on all those, he wants to cut. You know, America First is more a cut from any type of relations that are not interesting for the United States. And the second part, of course, is foreign relations that relates to international security. But from those, of course, there is a doctrine of disengagement. They want to get remain involved only in the type of foreign affairs that are still directly or indirectly beneficial to making America great again. So therefore, the doctrine at the international relations level is completely consistent and induced by the targets that they commit to try to go after in terms of domestic economic policy.
We're about to have Trump 2.0. From Trump 1.0, 8 years ago, what sticks out as the particular policies that are examples of this?
Well, one was tariffs and trade wars. And in fact, interestingly, in an interview at Bloomberg, he said that he wanted to insist now that his favorite word on the dictionary is tariff.
Right.
The continuity is definitely tariffs. What is new is that he's actually linking tariffs as a way to finance tax cuts, which was not a rhetoric he had before. And apparently it worked very well. Like the people who always wanted tax cuts on the Republican side were always there.
Yeah.
But somehow the fact that the Republican side and also the Democratic side are full of people with the protectionist type of demand liked the message of finance tax cuts with tariffs, which for some economists like us seems crazy, but it has a bite.
Also, he was and still is very definitely America First as a nationalist. And what policy examples, again, from the first time round are good examples of this?
Pretty much everything has been nationalist. Yeah. And in fact, even in foreign relations, which is important for this topic, what he wants is have relations with nations, not with, for example, Europe. Right. So Europe is not something that Trump likes. Trump is fine pushing national interest with other countries that want to push their own national interest. So it extends to others. But in terms of examples, other than protectionism, trade policies from the first part, he did not have a plan how to go farther. Now he does. Now what worries is that Project 2025 is a project that will make the nationalist agenda a strong part of the executive power. And what worries us is the weakening of the other powers.
Yes, now we are talking exclusively about Donald Trump so far in this. Is the purpose of your paper to examine the consequences of Donald Trump taking power, or is it a populist taking power and a superpower more generally?
The characterization of populist policymakers is general, but the fact that this is a case in which a winner-take-all system elects for the second time a populist policymaker in a superpower is the thing that makes the focus on Trump justified, because what we're interested in is the effect on the rest of the world. And as at the times of the Cold War, let's say, with the balance of power, et cetera, the primary interest was how would the equilibrium between Reagan and Gorbachev, how would it affect the other countries or the geopolitical order also outside that? Obviously, some traits of Trump's policies, you can find them in other policymakers of similar political type, but they don't have as much an effect on the rest of the world, of course. So that's why focuses on Trump.
At Vox Talks, we have regularly covered research on populism. Our most recent episode on the topic was an interview with Andres Rodriguez Posse on how economic stagnation combined with inequality has been driving the populist vote both in the US and in Europe. Listen to the episode, Economic Decline and the Rise of Populism. It was first broadcast in May 2024.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the theoretical model that's at the heart of this paper. The first part of that model is you use it to examine the likelihood that a populist would increase domestic conflict. What is the reasoning that you use here?
The intuition is this. If you focus on the countries that have had more frequently conflicts, internal conflicts over time. Mm-hmm. These are countries that are internally divided in terms of ethnic or religious big divisions, like sectarian divisions, etc. And typically you have one group that is in power and one group that it is not, and other groups as well. But
yes,
one big opposition group is always there in these countries that have conflicts, right? So what happens is that when a superpower uses the populist strategy that I mentioned before, namely protectionism and disengagement, the government controlling groups in these divided countries find themselves to have a smaller cake to share with the opposition because they are exporting less.
Right.
And they find that the US is not likely to help the opposition group if it was helping directly or indirectly before. So now through those two channels, the government is tempted to revise the social contract.
Mm-hmm.
And if you revise the social contract, you revise it downwards for the opposition group. And so that's why if the opposition group feels sufficiently weakened by the changes, we'll accept the revision, but that will mean greater inequality. Or if it doesn't accept the revision, it just means conflict. So it's always like either one or the other. So these transformations will push many ethnically divided countries or all ethnically or religiously divided countries to find themselves between the hammer and the hard place, as they say, right? Mm. Either accept a lower revision deal of the social contract with higher inequality or go to conflict.
Now, you also examine the likelihood of interstate conflict as well. Why might these populist policies make this other type of conflict more likely?
Right. So imagine any type of pair of countries that you want, maybe two neighboring countries in Asia, two neighboring countries in Africa. Take any of those pairs and then say that one of them is stronger. And in the cases in which this country is also more exposed to trade, this country is affected by the reduction in trade, both in terms of, again, having a status quo worse than before,
mm-hmm.
and by a greater temptation of using the relative strength. So if before was relatively stronger, but was not really that incentivized to start a conflict, now that the sort of peaceful surplus is reduced by the reduction in gains from trade, then the temptation to use force goes up, relatively speaking.
Also, you've spoken already about this preference for disengagement, but the United States can't disengage from every international dispute. Under what conditions do you assume that a populist does disengage?
You should correct your statement.
Right.
Because the disengagement doctrine, part of the populist set of commitments, does not necessarily mean disengagement of the U.S., from international disputes.
Ah.
It actually means that the US wants to disengage from helping a third country in a dispute with the fourth one.
Right.
Right. So we want to disengage from Ukraine in the relationship with Russia, but it doesn't mean that in fact Trump will be more peaceful in the international dispute that will involve the US directly.
Got it.
So that's an important correction.
Yes, absolutely.
Because the presence in the economic statecraft policy of this populist package, there could be more engagements of a direct sort.
But the disengagement in disputes of the indirect sort, under what conditions?
Well, that is pretty much always, because the condition for election, as you noticed, of a populist is that it brings positive responses in terms of economic security. So any previous engagement that was based on human rights protection or any other thing that is not related to bringing goodies to the US is something that is not going to be interesting.
I see. And the consequences of this internationally?
A lot of changes in the balance of power within and across other players, right? Within and across mm-hmm. other states. Because wherever there was an engagement, now there is a shock. That engagement is gone. That help to whatever group in the opposition or the government is gone. So you change the balance of power. And when there is a change of balance of power, there is always a temptation by one of the players to revise the status quo. And that, as I said, as a general rule, will either, you know, lead to a worse deal than before for one of the groups, or will lead to conflict because that worse deal is acceptable. So it's a very general thing that almost requires no condition.
We have all these possible consequences, this heightened risk that these consequences will occur. Is it possible to take these theoretical predictions from the model and apply them to what might happen in the world in 2025?
Yes, this we make a first rough attempt in the paper to do that,
yeah.
Especially for civil conflict. It's a bit easier to make such predictions for civil conflict for a number of reasons. For interstate, there are all kinds of complications related to the new coalitions that are forming. You know, think about how difficult it is to imagine how the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia, for example, will change, given that on the one hand, there is a confrontation ongoing, etc., but on the other hand, they both joined BRICS Plus, right? So there are coalitional forces that make it difficult to make exact predictions for interstate. But for civil war, it's pretty clear what are the 10 or 12 more endangered countries by the election of Trump.
How do you do this? Because very often when I talk to researchers about the data that they apply to their model, it's pretty obvious what that data is. What data are you using?
We use two types of data. One is a type of data that we developed with our team in another team for the publication on economic policy. And it's a data set where we measure for each major ethnic group on the atlas. So ethnic group everywhere in the world. We measure their relative political and economic power with respect to their government and their relative military strength, which was not easy because the groups that have never been to conflict, you don't have direct measures like for states. You don't have armies, weapons counts, you know, but you can do it with machine learning techniques, with sophisticated techniques. So once you have all those measures, you check which countries have already a tension due to the fact that some major opposition groups in the countries have a mismatch. Namely, they have political and economic power that is significantly less than their military strength.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically a necessary condition for this opposition group to be at all interested potentially in a conflict, right? A mismatch is like a necessary condition. But then on top of that, the additional trigger that you can check is, okay, is this country very much based on exports, right? Is the surplus, is the revenue of this country pretty much based on exports? And then this is a country that will be exposed to the trade war consequences of electing protectionists and having more protectionism in the world. So therefore, a country that simultaneously has an existing necessary condition already perhaps activated with this power mismatch and the opposition group that is severely mismatched in terms of relationship between economic and military. And on top of that is a country where the trigger kicks in because of the protectionism effects. That's the country where you should put a red color, right? You should start moving intelligence and start moving resources towards that country.
And which countries should we be coloring in red at the moment?
Right. In the map that we provide in the paper that emerges from this analysis, a few countries are pretty obvious and coexist with other predictions by other papers like Iraq, Mali, the Democratic Republic of Congo, etc. But there are a few others that we did not expect, or at least you don't find signs on the newspapers about, like Ghana and Botswana and Zambia and South Africa. Investors don't put them on a high conflict risk or country risk parameter, but all the conditions that we emphasize are there given the transformations that Trump will make to economic and engagement policies. And so these are countries that surprisingly, even though economically they are not in a condition as bad as some of the others, may have tensions that arise.
I take your point that your conclusions have to be more provisional for interstate conflict, but are there any countries there from your analysis that you have seen have a higher risk?
On one hand, the disengagement on the west side of the US, and given the attempt of the US to actually weaken Europe that we can anticipate, we can have that the coalition of the left is more sparse and less willing to help in the Middle East and in Asia, etc., or less able to help. Whereas on the latter side, there is a big strengthening because the BRICS Plus is only a vague idea of cooperation on many economic issues, also with contrast between India and China and so on. But the election of Trump will actually unify a little bit more, at least some countries in BRICS Plus, and there will be a broader description of influence, not only by China, but by other members of BRICS. So I expect, therefore, the conflict to happen in places that are at the floating frontier between the two blocs. A surprising area is the Pacific, because the Solomon Islands or the other constellation of islands that are northwest of New Zealand are countries where both China and the US used to try to have influence, but mostly on economic fronts. And now there are some places where, in fact, politically, they are worried because potentially the interest and the support of the United States for those that chose to have that support in the past will go away. And therefore, there'll be some attempt there to start some conflicts that we don't even know about. That area could be an area of friction, a bit like it is already under the sea, you know, with all the with all the blocks that are moving and are creating weird earthquakes. That's what we expect when two big coalitions are like two big blocks of rocks that are moving, and maybe one is going over the other, then there are earthquakes, right? And that's where we feel that the interstate frictions could be.
These big blocks that create the earthquakes, they set the political agenda, but there are 200 and something other countries in the world, in the international community. Is there anything that they can do to reduce this potential for conflict that you're identifying here?
Well, any country, and especially Europe, that has the potential to create itself as the United States of Europe, or at least there are people like me who pushed for the greater political and fiscal and military union of Europe since the beginning of the century. So in countries where there is an opportunity to strengthen the ability to be a player in the geopolitical player, now Europe is not that much a big geopolitical player at this point, but it could be given the amount of resources, the amount of people that live in Europe, etc. So what should it do if it wanted to have a role in the geopolitical context? Well, certainly should try as much as possible to stay away from nationalism, right? So all the potential threats that come to Europe come from the willingness of other populists like Orban, etc., to break the tendency to have European policies, to keep unanimity rule to make difficult decisions such that Europe doesn't make decisions. What, therefore, should Europe do? This situation where there is a lot of fragmentation and the creation of big blocks where Europe is not a player, one response would be to put on hold the widening of the European Union and think more about the deepening. I am in favor of a wider Europe intellectually, of course, and culturally, but I'm wary and worried about adding, for example, now countries like Serbia and Georgia for different reasons. Not because I don't want to be open to those different types of populations. To the contrary, personally, I would love it. But Georgia, there would be the possibility, the danger of another Ukraine confrontation, because it's again one of those countries at the border of the two blocks that we talked about for the undersea of New Zealand, right? And yeah. Serbia would be another country where, in case it is added to the EU with the current rules, it could create another veto point to a common defense or common policies of the EU in the geopolitical scheme. And therefore, those countries should be added when we are ready to make more decisions through majority rule.
Massimo, your analysis is fascinating, but it is also disturbing. I hope when we meet again that some of the things that we're worried about have not happened, but we'll wait and see. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The paper is called Populism and War, and the authors are Andrea Batozzi, Massimo Morelli, and Marcos Nakaguma. It was published in October 2024.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We have new episodes every week, so whatever type of economic research you like, we have something for you. And please remember to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Next week on Vox Talks, who's trading with Russia?